Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board game podcast about board games. I'm here with my great friend, Mark Bigney. My name is Michael Walker. Welcome to the show. First, we're going to talk about the games we played this week, then the news and why it doesn't matter, then our feature game of the week, which is DEI.
Yeah, that's all that anyone's been talking about in politics lately, DEI. And so we wondered why in the American election they were playing this game from Tommaso Battista. And so we decided to jump on that. And we're going to be talking about DEI. We're plugged into the zeitgeist here.
So, Mark, what games did you play this week?
As per usual, it's been a good week for games. Can't really complain. And first up, I would like to talk about This Is Not a Test. This Is Not a Test is a tabletop miniatures rule set. It is a post-apocalyptic skirmish rule set designed by Joseph McGuire. As per usual, one of my longtime collaborators in tabletop miniatures wargaming, the Hanwerker, suggested it, and we decided to give it a try. There's a lot to like about the rule set. I will confess at the outset that basically we played about a third of a game because... The point of failure was a not uncommon point of failure in the context of miniatures rule set, which was the scenario was desperately unsatisfying. It was an attacker-defender scenario where the defender was trying to move livestock across the map, and the attacker would show up at different stages of the board. In fact, they were obliged to split their forces, and the defender had a weird element of compensation, not only started off in control of all the livestock, which were the chief source of points, but they also got additional models, additional flunkies, cattle herders, to allow them to be able to move across the map. And so ultimately, it was a very, very lopsided experience. The Hanwerker was able to completely wipe out half my army on one side of the map in the context of the second set of activations. So that was weird. We called it at that point because not only was it the case that the perception was that the scenario was effectively over anyway, and I'm in favor of calling scenarios when they're basically done with, but it was the case that there just would have been a lot of activations to no purpose, because as I said, the defender got these extra hands, these extra farm hands that could move cattle across, and such as would have been moving the 6 inches, moving the 6 inches, moving the 6 inches, which would have been somewhat tedious. Now, all of that having been said, there's a fair amount in the rule set of this is not a test that I can recommend. Army building is striking a pretty good balance between freedom, restriction, and giving you options of lots of toys without making things overwhelming. And so you could get to a situation where there's lots of personality in the different units and the different armies without getting bogged down in too many rules. And so that's definitely advantageous. On top of that, they've got this interesting notion about how ranged combat ought to work in that you do activation tests, and it is possible that you're going to activate multiple models in a row. And if you engage in multiple ranged combats during your activation system, they are all going to be resolved when initiative passes over. So I activate my 3 dudes. I might have a certain number of ranged effects from those dudes. And after the activation turns over, we then resolve the effects of the wounds. So I might have killed you after the first activation. I might not have killed you after the third. I liked that interesting element of uncertainty. And it's an interesting sort of thematic and gameplay modeling. The thematic modeling is that melee is sort of quick and violent, and you see immediately the results of your effects. But if you're engaging in a firing line, if you've got a whole bunch of people that are firing their weapons, you might not know the results. So I liked the activation system. I liked how ranged combat worked. I enjoyed the army building, but unfortunately, the scenario that we tried, and In fairness, it's a random scenario generator. You're supposed to generate a random scenario, and they say this specifically so that you don't build your army specifically to counter the needs of an individual scenario. And I appreciate that. So it gives you further flexibility and a nice level of uncertainty with respect to your army building. You have to kit out not knowing what precisely you're going to expect. All that I enjoyed. We want to try to possibly this. What we ought to do is, you know, build our armies again with the expectation that we're not going to be building it for specific scenarios, but then look through the scenarios and just say, well, let's just try this one because the other ones look a little bit goofy. Anyway, so probably more to follow about this is not a test. Post-apocalyptic skirmish rules. Once again, this is by Joseph McGuire, published by World's End Publishing, all the way back in 2013. Walker, when you assert that games were not being designed,
I don't think it ever happened. Never, okay. Ever.
Sure.
And that is, this is not a test. Mark, you and I got to play the newest buzz called Lord of the Rings Duel for Middle-Earth. This is designed by Antoine Boza and Bruno Cathala and put out by Repos Production. And it's sort of like a, like I showed you, a hybrid of Splendor Duel and Seven Wonders Duel. And so there's multiple ways to win. You're drafting these cards out of this pyramid system and you're sort of building up your tableau in order to make it easier to buy these other cards, and you're trying to get the, you know, area majority on the map. You're trying to get sway all the different races of Middle Earth, or you're moving, you know, the race between Frodo and the Ring Bearers trying to get to Mount Doom. What do you think of Seven Wonders Duel?
Well, I haven't played Seven Wonders Duel, and actually this is supposed to be a riff on that series. One of the reasons why I never went to Seven Wonders Duel was because, despite the fact that we hear in So Very Wrong About Games like the output of Antoine Boza, Seven Wonders is one of the ones that we really don't like. And so that's one of the reasons why I avoided it. People rave about Seven Wonders Duel, though. And so on top of the fact that this was derived from a game system that I'm not really a fan of, and it's themed to something I really don't like, and so I don't have any enthusiasm for Lord of the Rings, I came with a certain degree of trepidation, but one thing that generated confidence was my experience with Splendor Duel. Once again, this is Bruno Cathala coming in and duelifying an existing game, and I thought that Splendor Duel was preferable to normal Splendor, and then so I had reason to believe that this system would be improved over Seven Wonders, and I did like it. I liked it more than Seven Wonders. The whole sort of pyramid drafting is kind of okay. I like the different victory conditions. The different victory conditions are cool. There's map domination, there's race domination, there's ring domination, as you say, and each one of them works on slightly different criteria. I feel like your first play of Lord of the Rings Duel for Middle-earth is going to be a little bit of a wash, because like many three-stage games, it escalates, and the cards in stage three are just vastly more consequential than the cards in stage one. For example, troop movement doesn't really happen until the later stages of the game. And on top of that, you have to know, to a certain extent, the composition of the deck, particularly in terms of some victory conditions more than others. Like, for example, the people's victory, gathering the different races of the Middle Earth, you need to know that there's only two copies of each race in the entire set of the three decks. Setting aside that, you might, if I wanted to be a little bit of a tryhard, and anytime a game makes me think that I want to be a little bit of a tryhard, I hold it against the game, I'd want to know how many ring movement points there were overall in terms of the structure of the game. Because, again, it's the early part, it's phase one. What is the value of advancing one or two steps on the ring track? It's tough to know.
I found the ring track to be odd, right? Because you can never get further away from the ring wraiths. Because every time Frodo moves, the ring wraiths move as well. They got this interesting, you know, clear plastic track. So you can never get further away. And so the ring wraiths have a finite number of rings they need to catch them. So they, one side has to go all in or the other type thing. It's either, you know, Frodo's going to get it to Mount Doom, or the ring wraith's going to catch. Or they're going to go back and forth and just stop each other. So it's one of these odd tracks.
It is just a cool cosmetic way to represent that I need to get to the victory threshold of 10 points before you get to your victory threshold of 10 points. They just wanted to represent it spatially so as to lean into the theme. And I appreciate that. It wasn't particularly counterintuitive. You explained it very well. It's visually delightful, and it's kind of fun, slidey thing. So whatever. It's a little bit of a toy.
There's a few bonuses on the way as you go. So maybe, you know, there's a reason sometimes to go up the track to get the bonuses. But other than that, it's fine. And it's got Vincent Dutrait art. The whole thing looks amazing. All fits in the box. Easy to set up. And it's fairly easy to teach. You know, you set up the pyramid and you're drafting cards and they do what they do, much like Marvel Champions.
I do wish that there was a little bit less of a sense of zugzwang. There's a lot of situations where the cards out there aren't very good for you, and you don't want to take any of them because they could reveal a spectacularly good card that your opponent is going to snatch up and that you're waiting for. Because again, you know that you need to get a certain proportion of these cards out, and so far they're hidden, and so you don't want to reveal any. And so a lot of our moves, particularly into the end, were driven almost exclusively by, well, I'm not particularly inclined to take this card, but if I don't, you're going to have more options, so this is what I'll take. That may be a feature, not a bug for some people, but for me, I found it a little unsatisfying, and it really leaned into this idea of you need to know what's in the deck. So part of me kind of wishes, actually, that maybe more of the pyramid were visible. That might be a way around it. I don't know if there are any house rules to that effect or if it would ruin other parts of the game. It's just on the face of it, that seemed like a bit of a counterintuitive and somewhat unpleasant play state for my preferences.
Well, especially when the world of two-player games is so dense and it's, you know, it's hard. It's a big fight to get to the table, and I don't think this has enough to get there.
I do really like the different victory conditions. There's a certain bit of all or nothing to two of them. The sort of map control, you're probably going to go back and forth a little bit. And that was pretty satisfying, I have to confess. It's a vaguely within striking distance of troops on a map type dynamic. But with this additional level of some troops that you can deploy on the map that can never be dislodged, but that are very, very expensive, particularly in the early parts. I liked a lot of it. I would like it more if I liked the theme a little bit more, probably, and I would like it more now knowing the composition of the deck, so I'd happily go back to Lord of the Rings, The Duel for Middle-Earth. So, designed by Antoine Boza and Bruno Catala, published by Repo Productions this year, and it is indeed getting a lot of new fans. Other recent development, we played Iron Forest. This is by Brian Gomez, which I learned is actually a pseudonym for a design team of other people, but I'm...
Oh.
But they want to identify as Brian Gomez? That's fine, I'll do that. Published by Brain Games, this is a development of their Ice Cool dexterity game system, which features two physical gimmicks that are great. One of them is nesting boxes that have doors in them. You set them up at the start of the game and you arrange the different boxes, and that means that there are gates you need to flick things through. And on that topic, in Ice Cool, there were little penguins that you got to flick. Now they're mechs. Going from penguins to mechs is obviously an improvement as far as I'm concerned. Not that I've got anything against penguins, particularly if they are the Euro variety, but I'd rather flick mechs, frankly. And I've talked about this before. You can start executing trick shots, not well necessarily, but within the context of a single play. There's definitely a higher skill ceiling, but there are neat things you can do in terms of curve shots and jump shots, and you can start engaging with that without engaging in a high degree of mastery. Like, I've seen people do things in Pitch Car and Bicycle, other dexterity systems that are genuinely impressive, but well outside the range of what a novice player might even be in the realm to attempt, let alone accomplish. On top of that, the engineering on Iron Forest is spectacularly impressive. It's got a dual layer setup where there's a bunch of boxes set up on the table level, and then there are these risers, which look like rocket boosters, that represent the floating city that's on a level above. How do you get to the floating city? Well, they come with these little catapults. We've been playing a lot with catapults lately.
Yes, we have had a lot of catapults lately.
What was
which is a good thing.
Yeah. What was your experience with the catapults of Iron Forest, Walker?
I think they did fantastic. Like you said, when you explained it, they just did a great job. There's none of this, you know, taking 15 shots and trying to finally do it. Almost every shot got you to the top. And then it's just a matter of tweaking the shot and getting the accuracy with it. So you didn't have to worry about getting up there. You got to concentrate more on actually making the shot that you wanted.
Yeah, look, and just to be clear, this applies to trick shots as well. I'm not insisting that on a first play or very shortly after approaching the game, you be able to nail complex or complicated shots perfectly. But what I want is a situation somewhat unlike the flick-em-up games. I found the flick-em-up games very, very frustrating.
Or like flick ships. There's that one scenario where you're just like constantly, and it's just like, no, this has become quickly unfun.
Exactly. I want to be able to do a thing, and if you want me to do a very, very specific thing, that I'm willing to accept a high degree of failure rate. So, for example, even with our game of Iron Forest, getting to the top level with the launcher, we had 100% success rate. But then there might be circumstances where, well, I care about what box I end up on the top level. Or, in the case of how you won the game, I need to hit somebody while using the launcher. And you did it. And it was awesome.
Yes. Agreed.
Now, we had to play the free-for-all version because Iron Forest has one of my least favorite player count stipulations in all of board gaming, which is you need to be playing with teams. It's a four-player game, two teams of two. Yeah, you can play with three, but that's a bit of a drag. And we're often at three here at So Very Wrong About Games, so it was a bit of an issue. The free-for-all scenario is like half the game. Normally, it's scenario-driven. And you get power-up cards, and you get more by knocking out your opponents. And so there's this offense and defense trade-off, and there's the possibility of special powers. But in the free-for-all, all of that gets junked, and it's just, here's a list of tasks you need to complete, and whoever gets it done first wins. And some of the tasks were a little bit weird. Like, one of them was, you need to be able to flick a die through two doors with one flick, which meant that you needed to have a die in the exact right place, because there's very few places where you can flick a die straight through two doors, and they don't curve like the pieces do. There was another objective, which was flick through two doors yourself the same
flick. I was going to top that, because in order to flick the die, you have to hit it with your mech. So you might have the die in the exact spot, but now you have to nudge it with your mech in order to, you know, be able to engage the die. So either get it into place or hopefully not push it out of place.
Yeah, and those were borderline frustrating. But overall, I'm very much looking forward to trying the actual scenarios, the actual game. I've tried the solo version. The solo version is pretty much just roll a die, see if you get damaged. Meanwhile, try to accomplish these goals as quickly as possible. But those are scenario-based, and they were therefore a little bit more variety and detail than in the free-for-all version. So I don't know. I would very much like to try it with four. Four people who like dexterity games is a bit of a lift, but no pun intended, but hopefully we'll get there. I was very pleased with Iron Forest, and I now feel much, much better after having spent what feels like years reading Kickstarter updates about getting the launcher right. They got it right.
They got it right.
Good job. So if you if you haven't tried Ice Cool, I recommend Ice Cool. We played Ice Cool Wizards not too long ago. I like that too. I've liked all the games in that series, and Iron Forest does indeed feel like the slightly more gamerly version. They comment in the publisher's notes that they thought very, very sincerely that Ice Cool was a family game, and they were very upset when it kept getting classified for nomination purposes and other purposes as a children's game, and they thought this was inappropriate. So like, okay, fine, let's design a mech game that'll definitely be for adults. Meanwhile, the mechs are like cute bunny animals and stuff.
Iron Forest.
Something along those lines. Anyway, so that's Iron Forest by Brian Gomez and Brain Games. Big fan. Hope to try to find myself in a position to play it some more soon.
So, Mark, you and I got to get Trudvang Legends back to the table. Designed by Jordi Allen, Farah Bros, Gilmhim Juliet, and Eric Lang, and four more. It was just a whole crew, a bus of designers pulled up and designed this game.
Marco Baggi, Francesco Nepitello, Umberto Pignatelli, and Fabio Tola.
So this is another giant CMON crowdfunding plastic fest. And it's very interesting. It's a bag builder, which we both love, and I was glad to get it back. It has a semi-interesting story. You're moving around the map, and then you're getting into fights, which is pretty well most of what the game is about. You're trying to upgrade your bag, upgrade your abilities. It feels a little bit like Faith Forge, but so because instead of pulling stuff out of your bag, you're rolling dice, and then you're just fulfilling your little ability recipes, right? So it had a little bit of that same feeling to it, but still was fairly interesting. What do you think getting it back, Mark?
I was a little frustrated by the way enemy attacks worked. So there's a deck of 12 cards. You pull one for every attack. It's not entirely unlike Gloomhaven. But the Gloomhaven deck is A, thicker, and B, swings less. So in Trudvang Legends, it ranges from -2 damage for the monster attack all the way to +3 damage, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you consider that the base attack values for most things is around 2, the difference between being whacked for 0 and being whacked for 5 is massive. It is very difficult to survive being hit for 5, especially when you get knocked out, you come back at 6. And we were in a position fighting the boss of the first scenario, and we were just being knocked out one after the other after the other. All that we needed to do was for one of us to survive a round with any of our attack abilities active, and we would have been fine. But we kept pulling the +3 attack card, because every time it gets pulled, it gets shuffled back in.
It's like 1 out of 20, I think. I'm not sure how exactly many cards there are, but there's not that. There's quite a few.
12-ish.
And we kept drawing this damn +3.
Sequentially, over and over and over and over again. We never pulled the miss, And I would have been happy with a plus two. Plus two would have been fine. There was one occasion where I said, well, so long as it's not a plus three, I'll be fine. Sure enough.
Plus three again.
And that happened a couple of other times besides. It was... Now, in defense of the game, I think we probably should have spent a little bit more time wandering around. I guess the term is faffing about doing side missions, because we had a lot of points that we could have been used to cashing in to build our bag to our specifications. But we got kind of a tunnel vision. We were just aggressively pursuing the scenario objectives, because in a lot of other campaign games of this ilk, you don't have a whole lot of time to waste. In Tridvanic Legends, I'm not saying it's going to be over long. Each scenario is pretty tight. There's a kind of natural progression of a single session, which I very much appreciate. But there would have been lots of time to go around and pursue side objectives. We just didn't. And so I think that was one downfall. We played it once a few years ago after the base game got fulfilled. Now there's all the stretch goal content. Unlike a lot of CMON games, there's not a bazillion side things. It's mostly just other campaigns. But there are a lot of new characters. And so I played one of the new characters there. They seem to be relatively well-designed, unlike some of the excesses of CMON of old, mentioning no Project Elites in particular. But at any rate, I enjoyed it. I still like the bag-building elements. It's a solid co-op system. I think it's got a solid press-your-luck element, which is also another mechanism that I enjoy. And despite the frustrations with the randomness, I would be eager to go back to it.
Agreed. I'm happy to get it back to the table anytime.
Well, that's great. That's Tridvanic Legends, designed by many, many people, published by CMON. We played another game of The Gang. Rest in peace, Corey Heath. And I have to say that the sort of forensic accounting of trying to reconstruct people's hands based on how they've been communicating is marvelous. This is a co-op poker game where the form of communication you have is taking these chips saying, I think I've got the worst hand of the round, or I think I've got the middle hand of the round, or the best hand. And you do that after every card reveal, because it's a Texas Hold'em setup. And being able to reconstruct what's going on is great. There was one instance where I had been announcing that I had a terrible hand, and then when the last card came up, I announced that my hand was slightly better than terrible, and I basically looked over at Hugh and was like, you know what I've got. And it's very clear. I had a pair, and the pair was the last card that got flipped up. I had a pair of sevens. The last card that got flipped up was a seven. I had a pair of sevens. That was transparently obvious. The goal being to correctly identify who has the best hand, the worst hand, and any hand in the middle. We only played with three. Three is by far easier than with more players. Natch, by virtue of that. I'm a little... So there are these specialist cards. If you do well, you get a penalty, making future rounds harder. If you do badly, you get a little bit of a leg up. What do you think of these cards, Walker?
I think they're fantastic. I know you didn't like that. There's one where you actually have to rank the winning hand. Like, everyone sort of bets on the last hand. You reveal the first two to see if you've at least got that far. And now it's time for the final, or more. In this, it depends on how many players you have. It's time for the final player to reveal their hand, but you need to rank it. You have to say, oh, we think they have triples or a flush or something. And I think that just adds another layer, because it's only once. And then you go, and if you don't get it, then you have three chances to lose and three chances to win. And they are in different difficulty, the challenge cards.
So that challenge card I thought was fine, the one we played with that time. There was another challenge card, though, that just makes the game more arbitrary and less interesting. So, for example, there was the challenge card that says basically you skip the first round.
Yeah, that's the number one. Yeah, you just don't bet on the first round.
Yeah, but it's more interesting when you're sussing out the information. And when you're depriving people of that information, yeah, you're making the game harder, but you're making it less interesting and more arbitrary, because you're just more room for guessing as to how good your hand is ranking relative to everybody else. I understand they want to make the game harder, give it a sort of a broader structure from hand to hand based on how well you're doing. Some of the challenge cards strike me as not interesting, that's all.
Agreed. That's The Gang by John Cooper and Corey Heath. I'm sure more to come. Put out by Cosmos, because it is fantastic. I'm wondering if I'm gonna try it at family days. I don't mean I'm Ooh. Gonna bring it.
Okay.
Bring it. And we'll see. I'll make the pitch and say how many poker players there are and see if it's something that they want to try. Anyway, that's The Gang. We streamed Wonderlands War. This is by Tim Elsner, Ben Elsner, and Ian Moss. Put out by Druid City Games. Yet another bag builder. And so you're sort of setting your bag up to fight all these battles, like three full rounds of five battles. So the game tends to last longer than it should.
Yeah, the tone of your voice is indicating a certain cadence of the game.
But I'm wondering, you know, are you going to get this feeling of building your bag or building towards something if the game isn't long enough? I am not sure. I've yet, usually I'm always full of suggestions, but in this game, I'm just not sure if making it shorter will not give you the same feeling of, so you have a tea party round where there's this ring of cards and you're moving around until everyone gets four of them. And this is how you build your bag or get, you know, new troops onto the board. And once everyone has done this four times, then you clockwise go around the board fighting these battles. And there's two different ways to bust. Either you go mad and that helps you reset your bag, but it puts the madness back in your bag, which kills your troops. Long story short, you want to stay in the battle by having troops there. And every time you pull these madness chips, you lose troops. And the big bust is, once you run out of troops, then you're out of the fight. You go down to zero. You get no benefits. You get no victory points. You don't get to put your castle there. You don't get to do the quest mark. No quests.
No quests?
No quests.
Oh.
And that is Wonderlands War. It's a very interesting sort of bag building combo. I love the fact that the chips are sort of generic. And so you can, there are, I'm surprised that in the expansion, we played with the new expansion. I was surprised in the expansion they didn't give you different chip sets because, you know, it's A, B, C, and D because the chips can mean anything. And so you can make up whatever rules you want, really, if you wanted to for these chips. And I love the fact that that'll change up the game every time. And so you get interesting combos depending on the order that you flip these chips out. And anyway, love Wonderlands War. We'll never get rid of it. Love playing it.
I agree with you that it is unfortunately overlong. I mean, the battle system is interesting, but not entirely unlike Quacks of Quedlinburg, another bag builder. You're just sitting there watching everyone sequentially pull out these chips over and over and over again, and it gets a little repetitive and very procedural, but you have to do it that way because that's how the troop system works, that's how the bag system works. You need to have all these atomistic little pulls, but oh, it can drag, absolutely, especially for people not involved in the fight. Oh my goodness.
Well, you get to wager, though. If you're not in the fight, you get to wager.
Look, sometimes the fights are really consequential and you really care and you get to root for someone to fail because you want your friends to fail because that's what friendship is. But by the same token, sometimes it just takes too long.
Agreed. That is Wonderlands War with the Shards of Madness expansion.
So you mentioned pitching the gang in a family contest and we played Scout today. This is by Kei Kijino, published by Oink Games. And Scout is now available in a mass market version. It's in big box stores everywhere. And frankly, the holidays are coming up, Walker. We don't really do gift guides here at So Very Wrong About Games. But I have to say, people are broadly familiar with climbing games. A lot of people are. And even if they're not familiar with climbing games, they're probably familiar with trick-taking games. And climbing games and trick-taking games are very, very similar. I think Scout is an excellent suggestion for people who like traditional card games because I think they would be able to wrap their heads around it.
Yes, for sure. If you have families that already play card games, I'd say yes. But if they're just sort of not gamers at all.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not suggesting. Yeah. Important caveat. Absolutely. Yes. Scout is not going to convince people who hate card games to like card games. But if these are people who play a lot of traditional card games, this is absolutely, I think, something you could play with non-hobbyist card gamers. And Scout is marvelous. What I adore about Scout is the fact that you're constantly faced with this choice of playing what you got or feeding points to other people and building a better hand. And that tension is really well implemented. And I always feel like I'm making the wrong call. It's just like, ooh, I'd really like to get to trip nines, but can I really feed Walker another point on top of all the points he's already scored? Why do I keep feeding him points to take his cards? It's supremely well done. If you haven't tried Scout, I highly recommend it. It's probably not at its best with three. We played with three, and it's a little too easy to end the round with three, and it's a little too short. I feel like the luck of the draw is going to, very much like trick-taking games, it's very difficult to find that ideal point where you're playing enough rounds to sort of even out the luck of the draw, but it doesn't overstay its welcome. Scout with four or five, I think, is preferable. But with three, I'd still happily play. Scout is extraordinarily well done. It's probably, all told, my favorite Oink game. I realize that's heresy to the Oink fanatics amongst us.
It's going to get us a lot of trouble.
Send all your complaints to support@aircanada.ca. Be sure to reference Kevin Lacker in the comments.
Yeah, you'll need that for later, I'm sure. So make sure you write that down now.
Absolutely. So that is Scout.
We also brought Fromage back to the table, and this time we decided to draft the building. So there are four buildings printed on your player boards that you can play with when you first start. And then in later games, they have this giant bag of, you know, 30 to 50 different buildings, and you sort of draft four of them, and then you can replace any of the ones printed on your board as you see fit, thereby sort of making it sort of like a strategy or a way to play for that game. And it's a very sort of visual game because you're placing out workers and the whole board spins. And depending on how the workers face you will depict whether or not you're going to get them back every turn or not.
Yeah, the board spins like some kind of circular... like a
cheese wheel.
Oh my goodness.
Madness.
Did you get that in the designer's notes?
I did.
Okay.
I had to read it. I didn't understand it either at first.
I mean, it would be in French after all.
That's right. So you're either making cheese or getting resources, and you can, you know, add fruit or jam to your cheese, or you're putting cheese on tables or on shelves or invading with cheese, you know, all sorts of different things.
I don't think that's how it works.
It has a map and it's area majority mark. It means you're fighting with the cheeses. It's the way games work.
Okay. By the way, I think as somebody who grew up in French Canada, you're mispronouncing it. It's pronounced Froma.
Froma?
Because in French, you drop the last sound. This is what Americans taught
me. Ah. I thought it was like a story from a wizard, right? From mage. You know, like just some very, you know.
Nailed it. It is so tight and engaging and visceral and immediate. There's an immediacy to Fromage because... Look, I like gathering resources to pay for things as much as the next guy, but it just feels so liberating to be like, oh, that's the hardest kind of cheese to make. I could just make it. You'll pay for it later because your worker's not going to come back for a long time. And yeah, two turns from now and you've only got one worker to place, or worse yet, zero workers to place, you're gonna really, really regret that past Mark did that stupid thing. But for present Mark, oh, present Mark loves that stuff. Present Mark loves not having to pay for anything.
I really wish we had timed that game because I'm sure it was... close to 30 minutes.
That sounds about right. It's very, very well done. If and I don't think it's too fast either. I mean, the maps are well calibrated for the amount of cheese you get to put out. And you do have some strategic trade-offs to determine whether you want to build the buildings, how many buildings you want to build, what kind of resources you want to lead into. Yeah,
like how many resources to get. Like if you get three resources, then you're going to not see that worker for three turns. So deciding, you know, what to get. I love it.
That's future Mark's problem.
Future Mark, yeah.
Present Mark has three berries.
And if you're tryharding it, you're also blocking that three space for other players for three turns, right?
That, I think, is...
I'm not saying it's huge, but it's something that's happening.
I'm a little concerned that some groups, not us, but some groups might enter a situation where you have to implement some kind of house proviso that you don't... You shouldn't be staring at what your neighbor is doing before you take your turn.
That's right. You only get to engage with the section of the cheese that is in front of you at the time.
Yeah, so it's simultaneous play. That's one of the reasons why it's so quick. It's kind of worker placement, but honestly, the blocking elements are very, very subdued. It's just how much of an investment, how long are you willing to wait, how much are you willing to commit in order to make this thing being cheese.
And that's Fromage, designed by Matthew O'Malley, Ben Rossette, and put out by Road to Infamy Games.
Now I'm very confused. I thought it was From Mage.
It depends. Well, I think we need to enunciate in whatever country we're in at the time. So if we travel, then we'll have to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, we have to be on the plane to get to do the Brussels version of this podcast pretty soon. So.
Exactly. Well, we'll confer with our affiliates in Brussels.
Okay.
They keep sprouting up all over the place.
Oh my goodness. Who have I shackled myself to?
And those are the games we played this week. Now, a quick break while we pay some bills.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter.
So, I remember when The Witcher 3 was released, which is a very popular Vidja game. I have not played this Vidji game, but a lot of people really got obsessed with the side game. A lot of video games do this, right? In the universe of the video game, there's a card game or a board game or some other kind of game. Sometimes it's underwater space football. Sometimes it's a card game.
It's funny I did that because the new season of Arcane is out.
Okay.
Right? And they had that, what I forget, I should have, what's the name of the stone game they have?
Dude, I don't like that universe.
Anyway.
I didn't like Arcane. What can I tell you?
Anyway, I think it was only in the war. Anyway, they have a table and they're playing this game. And I'm just like, stop trying to make it a thing, okay? Guessing stones is not going to be a thing.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. Anyway, setting that aside. So Gwent was really popular. A lot of people really liked playing Gwent, which is the card game in the Witcher universe. And people would spend hours just playing Gwent. I remember that there was a limited edition of The Witcher 3 that came with a Gwent set. And people were like descended on that like ravenous wolves. And there have been various attempts to make physical versions of Gwent a thing in the interim. But now there's actually going to be like a legit Gwent card game. That is being published by a Canadian publisher, No Loading Games, and they plan on releasing the starter set sometime next year. I'm not too sure how mercenary they're going to make it. I don't know if this is a blind purchase deal, or if it's going to be fixed sets, or even if in that context, how often the fixed sets are going to come out. There's a lot of minefields you can engage in, but there's going to be a physical version of Gwent.
Well, they did that for, I think, Game of Thrones, too. I think it was called, Savat? No.
Savas, I think.
Yeah, Savas. That's right.
I don't know how it's pronounced.
It's like a chess-type game.
Yeah.
There's been all sorts of... they even did it for Quidditch.
Yep. They also did it for the weird game they play in Ankh-Morpork for the... A lot of made-up games like that get physical implementations.
So we love Micro Macro, and sometimes it's hard to get over here in North America because it's all coming from Pegasus Spiel over in Germany. But now there's going to be a North American distributor, Hatchet Board Games, is now taking over Micro Macro. So now it'll be more available, I'm sure, to us people over across the pond.
Reiner Knizia is going to be publishing a new tiling game.
No.
Yes.
Do tell.
Well, there's a whole bunch of reprints and redesigns of old designs that he's done. But this is a new design. It's called Ape Town. It's going to be published by Piatnik. We're going to be curious to take a look. Despite the fact that it is, once again, anthropomorphic animals. This time, once again, anthropomorphic animal gangsters. What is with anthropomorphic animal gangsters being so overwhelmingly popular? One explanation for why it's so popular, and we've mentioned this before, and people mention this all the time to us, is that, well, it's a way to avoid any potentially problematic historical or cultural baggage that other settings might have. I can't help but notice, I'm not going to make a huge thing out of this, but on the cover for Ape Town, there's kind of a silhouette of a sea at the beginning. So it kind of looks like Cape Town, but they blanked out the sea. Look, I'm not going to get too deep into this, but don't make a connection between people from Africa and apes. Just don't. I'm sorry. It's very strange. Anyway, all that having been said, curious about how the game's going to shake out.
So I'm going to bore everyone with why I started this podcast in the first place again. It was back in the day. I saw how sort of the media, the content was being made for our hobby market. And it seemed to be leaning towards making people buy the games. There was no sort of definition between, you know, hyping or you know, just, you know, paid content versus critical reviews. So I just said to Mark, I think we should start this thing. We will take no sponsorships. We'll do no paid content whatsoever. We will do critical reviews with no outside influence whatsoever. And that is what we've done. So there's new news. Play to Z has signed a strategic partnership with a game review channel, Shut Up and Sit Down. They're going to sort of work together to put out a bunch of games that we enjoy, like Dogs of War. And that's interesting to see, this sort of reunion.
Yes, we think it's important that board game media, that there be independent voices that are beholden only to their audience, as opposed to more pay-for-play advertorials, but we'll see how this shakes out.
And that's the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our feature of the game, which is going to be DEI.
DEI is Divide et Impera. This is published by Ludus Magnus Studio, which is Latin for Big Ludus. And it was originally published in 2022, but in the way of things, there was a crowdfunding campaign for expansions and a reprint. And this is where we got on board. This was designed by Tommaso Battista, who is perhaps best known for co-designing Barrage with Simone Luciani. He doesn't have too much of an independent publishing profile. Besides that, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in DEI?
So in DEI, it's very much a watch how the game is developing and being able to turn on a dime, because you're going to be pushed around. Things are going to be impossible to achieve. You're going to have a hand of cards, and you have certain goals that you need to achieve to try to eke out the most points you can. And seeing as the game state changes so often, you'll need to be able to switch your strategies and do what you need to do when you need to do it.
How nice of you to complain about getting pushed around and making that meaningful eye contact with me. I figured it had been about 20 minutes since you've complained about me being a bully, despite the fact that in our last game of DEI, after I took any region, you immediately on the next action big-leagued me with twice as many people getting there.
These are lies. All lies.
No.
So let's just start with the game prep of this game.
Yes.
It's no small matter. There's the game, once it's all set up, is fantastic. It's this three-dimensional terrain pieces. The problem is that you have to build all of these terrain pieces. They give you these two giant sheets of double-sided stickers, and you have to layer all of these, you know, game pieces together, get them lined up so they look just right, because not only they have to line up with the other hexes, the other squares that you put out. Lots to do. And then just the setup itself, you know, luckily enough, they let you, you know, set up the map however you want to, but then you have to populate it. Almost all of, like 98% of the resources that you're going to have in the game are on the board at the start. So you have to populate the whole board with all of these resources. There are these strongholds that you have to put out. So they all have to be gauged and the cubes for them have to be put out. And then there's four different markets of cards that have to be sorted because, you know, there are drones. We'll get into the drones later. So the drones have to first be put into the market deck, shuffled up, and then populated into the markets. So the setup is huge as well.
I don't know about huge. I mean, it's no joke. It's substantial. But if you compare it to your average medium weight Euro, then it's not a whole huge deal, right? We're not talking about like a supply of several different kinds of tokens that need to be stacked in a particular order. But yeah, there are four different decks of cards that need to be shuffled. The building the boards is indeed a huge pain. And if you're off by a little bit, it'll ruin the visual appeal because everything needs to be lined up just right. And thankfully, this is not a task that I had to do. This is something that we decided to assign collectively to our person recovering from a stroke, which I think is an appropriate allocation of resources.
Kills two birds with one stone. You know, you get some physio done, you know, physio going there, you know, hand movement, all that stuff.
You're welcome, Walker.
Yeah, you know, you are a saint.
I'm such a humanitarian. Yeah.
What would I do without you?
Yeah. But yeah, messing around with double-sided stickers and assembling the boards is, it's a huge task, but you did it perfectly. And consequently, the visual appeal is tremendous because it's not even just visuals. The salience of being on higher ground is huge. It's very, very consequential. There are resources that only show up on ground level, and then there are resources that only show up on the upper level. And it's very nice that there's only two different kinds of resources. That makes things very simple. But on top of it, it means that the upper level resources are vastly more valuable.
And puts big emphasis on movement, which is a big issue in this game. It's very hard to move. First, I'm going to go over that. It has sort of that scythe problem. And I'm going to compare it more to Marco Polo than scythe. Because in Scythe, you have these giant stompy mechs. So it makes it look like it's a fighty game because there's all these troops and these giant drones. It looks as though you're going to get into this like hoedown area control game. That does not happen.
Have you ever been to a hoedown, Walker?
I have not. Apparently, they're fantastic, though.
So in my experience, hoedowns don't tend to have people armed with miniguns.
I don't know. They usually happen in Texas. I think you might be wrong.
I'll check my research on that.
Because not many things kill. Hardly anything. It's very seldom do you actually lose troops. But like Marco Polo, you need to look. There's this whole board that has objectives. And you sort of need to plan out your game. You can't just wait from round to round and figure out what you're going to do. You need to look ahead. See how the game is going to progress. See what you need to do. Because it's also a hand builder. So you are going to be playing 24 cards throughout this whole game. And in order to get more cards, that is one of those 24 actions. So it's very, you know, very intricate sort of figuring out when's the best time to buy these cards. Because not only are they usually much better than the cards you have, but they're also going to be worth points. So figuring out the best advantage, which cards are going to help your strategy, and when to buy them.
There's an interesting dovetailing going on, because there's a lot of area majority like competition going on the board, and at the same time there's this kind of sort of deck building issue, because as I mentioned before, there are two kinds of resources. What do you do with resources, you might want to know? You buy cards. That's it. The only thing you do with resources is buy cards, with some very, very minor exceptions. You know, you'll get in-game points for leftover resources that can be non-trivial, but they're not going to be a huge, huge deal. And you give up tempo by buying a card, not just an action, but tempo. And it's... I'm of two minds with respect to the card building, frankly. I wish that, to a certain extent, the card purchases didn't feel as often as they do as just a blunt way of converting resources into points. Because sometimes you get to buy a card and you're buying it because it's a cool card. And that's great, because then everything's really coming together and I feel like the trade-offs are really well done. But very often, especially in the last round of DVD Ed Impera, and there's only four rounds, often it's just a blunt, okay, what's the best rate of return I can get for these resources, which is less satisfying, honestly.
Agreed. So you're playing three phases per turn and four turns, like Mark just said, and each phase you're going to play out two cards, do all the actions on those two cards, and then it'll be the next player's turn. And the second phase, you're doing the same thing, playing two cards, but then you're going to try to get these feats, right? Where you're going to, you have to have control of the strongholds that are on the board.
Outposts.
Sorry, there are outposts on the board. Three different colors, green, red, and blue. And you have to have control of two of them in order to flip over your feats, which are these usually fairly powerful special abilities that you might have either drafted at the beginning or got randomly. And I really love the part where you don't have to continuously hold these. You need, at this particular point, at the end of your second phase, you have to have control then, and then after that, it doesn't matter. You now have these special abilities. Sure, they're worth one or two points at the end. A lot of the objective cards also reflect on these strongholds.
Outposts.
I'm sorry, we called them several different things. I will try to say outposts. Anyway, what do you think of these feats and outposts?
It's funny that you say that you don't need to hold on to them, because you definitely held on to yours, Walker.
Well, it's meant other people can have them, Mark. They're mine.
I really love the timing in DVD Ed Impera, because, as you say, you get to upgrade your feats, but only after the second action round of the turn. And so you have to really figure out, like, when can I go and snatch this? If I'm holding it on to the beginning of the round, that's possibly peaking too soon and someone's going to get it for me. Or if it's going to take me the entire round to do it, that's going to be too late. And so figuring out whether it's worth it to try to grab onto it at that time, on top of the fact that there are these other timing considerations influenced by the fact that you're giving up tempo when you're buying cards. Sure, you may even be using those better cards later on that same turn, but again, you wasted half of an action to go get it. And then there's the fact that on top of grabbing these feats, giving you these special powers and points, there's also the end of round scoring, which is another area where I think that DVD Ed Impera is very interesting, but sometimes less interesting than it could be. So after the second action round of three, you can upgrade feats. Doesn't matter if you do it earlier or later, just after the second, that's the only time it matters. And then at the end of the third action round, you score. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about the scoring system?
So like you said, it's very much about timing, right? I enjoyed it because it happened several times. It wasn't like one of these one-off things where it's just this weird sort of system where you really need, there are four different columns of objectives that correspond to the four different turns of the game. And if you're scoring and you get to pick one of those columns, one of those two cards in that column. And if it's in the column of the turn that you're in, you'll get the higher points. Or if it's one, we say in the future, in one of the future columns. But if you score the future columns early, then you're going to have to go to a past one later on in the game, and you're going to score the lesser points. So I enjoy it because you can see what people are trying to score. And you look at it on the board and say, well, he's obviously doing that. I'm going to go for the thing that is not being, you know, fought over or easier to get, and sort of, you know, manipulate it that way.
I really like the trade-offs implied by that system. And as you say, if you ever score a future objective now, that means you're going to have to score a past objective later and get the lower score. Sometimes, though, the way the specific cards shake out are less interesting than they could have been. So, for example, there's one objective, which is have troops on the board. Just have, I shouldn't even call them troops. They don't really fight. Have units out on the board. And it's very remunerative if you have all of your units out. And if it's in the third or fourth round of the game, if it's in that third or fourth column, that's pretty much guaranteed points that everyone's going to get.
Because like we said, you're very seldom are you removing troops.
Yes. If there were more opportunities to remove troops, if it were the case that you could, if they were staggered, if these objective cards necessarily came up in certain columns as opposed to others, I don't know if there would be a good way to do that in a thoroughgoing way, then there would be more of a tension. Do I want to try to rush and deploy a lot of people early on, not necessarily get them where they want to be and score that earlier at a better rate? Or do I just take my time and accept the fact that I'm going to have more troops out but score it in lesser value? That would have been more interesting. When it's later on, it takes out a lot of that consideration. On top of that, too many of the objective cards are just the same. Presence at outposts, majority at outposts. And the presence at outposts scoring cards, I would argue, are even less interesting than that because there's nothing you can do about it, by and large. There's very, very, very seldom is it the case that you can prevent someone from getting some amount of presence at an outpost. Because, again, there's not a whole lot of combat. There's not a whole lot of way to kill things. And so you can just plop a guy there and guaranteed points, more or less.
Well, you have to get it there early because this game, a lot of the things are based around majority. So you cannot just move one guy in that particular case. I do have that guy, I have it here as well, that the missions are a little wonky because, like you said, it would be nice if they were in a sort of a tiered system somehow, depending on what round they go into certain rounds. And also, it really messes with turn order as well because I'm sure you're going to have that in here as well. It's a problem with turn order. And my reflection on that is a little bit like Tikal, because in Tikal, going sooner is better because you'll get to those monuments and you'll be able to score them before everyone else sort of, you know, fills it up because of this majority problem. So if you get there sooner, then you're going to get to these areas easier. Whereas if you're later in the turn, they've already been filled up, even though there's like a massive amount of other objectives you can go for. If it's that one for that particular round, it might be an issue.
Honestly, I don't think it's a big deal. Divide et Impera has a very simple turn order structure whereby at the end of the round, whoever's in last place goes first, whoever's in second last goes second, etc. And again, the idea is to give some sort of advantage to people who are behind. But there are two complicating factors. Number one, it is not always the case in all areas of the board that there's a first mover advantage. Sometimes there's a second or third mover advantage. And on top of that, there's the cards, which is just more... it's mostly just noise as to whether or not you want to be first or last. It's more or less arbitrary. So there's the fact that it doesn't always play out the case that the first mover has an advantage. And number two, there's a large number of ways to mess with the default sort of movement restrictions. So for example, there's what we think is possibly the most powerful drone in the game, the one that just moves more or less wherever it wants to go and just deposits people. You don't need to have a stronghold there. You don't need to have a refuge there. You don't need to have been there before. You don't care if someone else has majority. It's like, oh, just two more people there. Okay, fine. And there's just a lot of ways to get around it. And so consequently, I really wish that there was a slightly more curated option for the victory cards. When it works, it's great. And when it doesn't work, it's just kind of there.
Agreed. Let's go on to the drones. But in order to talk about the drones, let's first talk about the factions. So in the base game, there's four factions. Like Mark said, lots of expansions. So there are a ton of different factions. But each faction sort of has a drone that accompanies them. But when they build drones in this world, they are not allowed to get firmware updates. So they can be super easily hacked. Because like I said, whenever you take your faction and then it comes with one drone card that you get to activate that drone with. It also comes with three other drone cards that get shuffled into the market deck that anyone gets to buy. Therefore, anyone gets to use your drone, which is terrible. They should not be allowed to do that.
You only say that because you get the better drones.
It's true.
There's not a whole lot of faction asymmetry. And I will admit, the last time we played, I was complaining a lot. I must have been just in a bad mood. But there's not a huge amount of difference between the different factions anyway. Like, honestly, if you want to go and buy the better drone cards, odds are excellent. Not guaranteed, but excellent that you'll have an opportunity to do so.
It's true. You start with the drone and only one drone card, but other people can buy them. You do have a leader that has a special ability, but... it comes in sometimes, as you know, we talked about with the majority and the fact that in the game that Mark and I played last, we moved our leader in the first turn and then didn't move him again for the rest of the game. And also the faction starting decks are slightly different as well.
A little bit. The biggest differentiation between factions are the feats, which are going to be different every round. They're not tied to the factions, and you have to work to unlock them. So there's greater agency there, and it's much more appreciated. The feats can really mix up the game in a substantial way. And so I'm at least glad that the more interesting asymmetry was loaded into the one where there's going to be more variety.
I love how the fact, even with four players, it moves very quickly. The actions are fairly basic. It's like move, put guys out, do stuff. The iconography is actually quite good.
For the most part.
For the most part. And I like the fact that, you know, some of the actions have different colors. So they have like advanced actions. They have great sheets that have printed. Oh, we're going to talk. Yes. And there are some glaring, you know, problems with those sheets. But overall, they're not too bad.
This is a personal bugbear, but I think it's worth emphasizing.
Yeah, it's to do with the buildings, right?
Yes. You cannot have asymmetry or inconsistency in how you are expressing things in a reference document. So in Divide et Impera, there are three different kinds of buildings you can build. One of them, on the reference sheet, the text on the reference is exactly the same as the text in the rulebook. And it says, in order to build this here, you need to have a unit there. Fine. Makes perfect sense. The other two, on the reference sheet, and keep in mind, most of the actions in the rulebook, they copy the verbiage exactly from what's on the reference sheet. The other two buildings don't mention on the reference sheet that you need to have a unit there. And in the rulebook, they explain that you need to have a unit in or near to there based on the kind of thing that you're building. And if you're going to mention the restriction in one of them, you got to mention the restriction on all of them. And that, that's just asking for trouble.
Agreed.
It's a small thing, but it's very consequential at times.
So there's buildings. There's, like Mark said, you can build a sort of a new camp where you get to place your units. You can build bridges, which like lead to the map looking even cooler. You can build elevators because it's hard to get to the second story of some buildings. All in all, it makes the game look fantastic, especially, you know, when you have, you know, the troops all around the buildings. Anyway,
we have the miniature version of Divide et Impera. There's also a meeple version where there's some screen printing going on. I haven't seen the meeple version in person, but some of the designs look pretty okay. This is going to be an expensive product regardless, so if you want to save the money, because it plays like a Euro game. It's very Euro-focused in a lot of ways, especially insofar as there's not a whole lot of combat. There's a lot of emphasis on resource gathering. And honestly, the competition over resource gathering is actually where I find the more interesting competition. Because as you said, during setup, that's the lion's share, the overwhelming majority of the resources that you're ever going to see. And this is the kind of thing that dawned on me about halfway through our first game. It's like, wait a minute. Nothing's coming back. There's no refresh phase where more resources get seeded over the board. There's some special abilities that give you more resources onto the board, but they're hard to come by and typically difficult. And so you really feel like you're strip mining this board. And so that, I think, is the biggest first mover advantage. The ability to go out and grab these things before other people can. I think that's the best justification for early turn order that there is.
And after four rounds, you have an end game. You get some points. You get to have all the cards that you bought have some point value on them.
Which could be huge
if you hold any stronghold,
outposts.
If you have any outposts, they're worth a point each at the end.
Yeah, it's mostly just the cards you get.
Some resources are worth points.
There's a non-trivial number of points you get for the number of feats you've unlocked. It's 1, 3, 6 after if you've unlocked 1, 2, 3. But frankly, if you are not in a position to, like, some games I've trivially unlocked all three, and some games I've had to fight to even get one. But in those cases, you better know which one you want to unlock and work on that one.
So overall, I really feel as though DEI is going to make a backdoor table again. I have a feeling that if not I, other members will buy some of the expansions. We already have the one that came with the second crowdfunding thing where it has, you know, one or two extra factions that we haven't tried yet. So I'm looking forward to trying that. They very much change how the whole sort of game works. So we sort of left them out just so we can get the experience of the base game. So I'm looking forward to trying these new factions out and getting some expansions. Some of them actually come with like landmarks that you put out the map that sort of change up how you play. So that sounds very cool as well.
Yeah, Ludus Magnus does not shy away from releasing lots of expansions for their properties. And I hope that the expansion material is as interesting. Yeah, they really do change up the rules of the game these other factions do, which is weird because, as we commented, the four factions in the base game are not very different from each other, and so they really decided to make the expansion factions very outre, and so we never felt comfortable diving into them until we were fully confident with the base game, and we definitely didn't want to play with new players with any of these expansion content. So yeah, and I'm equally enthusiastic with our chances of getting Divided Impera back to the table. I don't think I necessarily enjoy it as much as you do. Again, I feel a little frustrated by how the victory conditions don't shake out as well as they ought to most of the time, but that's more like a sense of wasted potential. But I do very much enjoy playing Divided Impera, and I'm looking forward to seeing how the expansions mess with the system.
Sure, I'm hoping that some of these expansions come with more objectives that will, you know, inflate that deck and therefore give it a more robust feeling, because it is pretty painful.
Yeah, yeah, something weird and wacky, or structuring the objectives based on when they might show up to, again, the number of troops on the board thing is a particular culprit. Any number of those things might do it. It's just, it's a really interesting system that can encourage trade-offs when the cards shake out in just the right way.
Agreed.
So that's Divide et Impera, designed by Tommaso Battista and published by Ludus Magnus Studio in 2022. Probably more to follow, and probably more on the expansions to follow.
Agreed.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to spend the time with us a great deal. Please let us know if you have any suggestions, comments, problems, issues. And our normal contact information is support@aircanada.ca. We hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McMahon. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.